Welcome to the IDC podcast. The IDC promotes independent research on antitrust and competition law and policy issues, being also the point of contact between all those who have a special interest in the area, both in Latin America and globally.
In every aspect of life, it is invaluable to know and understand the causes of things. Antitrust and competition law and policy is no exception to this rule. In his recent book, Monopoly in America, a follow-on project of his previous one, Antitrust and Competition Laws, our guest today, Barry Hogg, sheds invaluable light to the better understanding of current law and policy as well as the institutions of competition law in the US. Studying the history of the evolution of competition law and policy helps to understand the present, as well as to imagine and build the future. Revisiting the historical origins of many of the institutions and legal figures of competition law helps to better understand the reasons for things, their foundation, and on many occasions what should be their specific application in specific cases. Monopoly in America largely fulfills this objective. American history did not begin in 1890, and American attitudes towards monopoly did not begin with the Sherman Act. Colonial Americans did not need instructions from Louis Brandeis to oppose monopolies. Americans have always hated monopoly, both public and private. At the same time, Americans have accepted government grants to incentivize production and innovation. And private monopolies resulting exclusively from skill, foresight, and industry have been viewed as welcome entrepreneurial success. Monopoly in America offers a tour to the American experience with the notion of monopoly, including Professor Hogg's three kinds of monopoly from a historical perspective that he divides in four eras. While doing so, he examines the American anti-monopoly tradition from its inception in the early 1600s to the present debate about the effectiveness of antitrust laws to deal with today's monopolies. Our guest, Professor Barry Hogg, is a leading expert on antitrust law. He's a former partner at Skadden, former director of the Fordham Competition Law Institute between 1974 and 2015. He's a former professor of U.S. and international antitrust law at Fordham Law School, Michigan Law School, Monash University School in Melbourne, Australia, New York University Law School, and University of Paris in France. He's the author of many books and articles on antitrust and competition law and policy, including the annual volumes of the Fordham Competition Law Institute. Barry is also a member of IDC's International Advisory Board. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Okay, well, look, thank you, Pablo. I really appreciate this opportunity. As you know, I enjoy your part of the world, and I enjoy getting to people from your part of the world. So, Monopoly in America. Just quickly, religious people, political people have been condemning both monopoly and, in a way, more importantly and more vaguely, monopolists. So Muhammad, for just two examples, Muhammad in the Quran says that he who monopolizes is a wrongdoer. Okay, right, all right. Charlemagne condemns monopolists. Hmm. You know, we got to execute all the monopolists, right? So this goes back years, right? So I decided to look at, and of course today, monopoly or dominant position is one of the three major elements of modern competition laws, right? It's cartels, dominant position, monopoly, and mergers, right? So even today, very differently, but today we still talk about monopoly and monopolists. All right, so I decided to have a look at, well, there's a tendency, at least in the United States, there's certainly a strong tendency among lawyers in the United States, because that's part of our, say, interesting legal education, which is completely ahistorical, at least compared with Europeans, right? So we've always been condemning, we have antitrust laws that condemn monopoly.
You said in your book that there are mainly three kinds of monopoly from a historical perspective again. Can you just give these three definitions and then from there go to the evolution in history?
Okay, so the first concept, the first concept, which was very important. Okay, the first concept is price gouging. Let's say, and the best way of this is a very vague concept that emphasizes more monopolists than a monopoly. Yeah. And the best way of understanding, and this is well back before before colonial America, there's tremendous. You see this in food riots in the middle, particularly in Europe, because we know a lot about Europe, right? Okay, it's a scenario. There's a famine. Or war, some kind of military activity that destroys the crops, and the price of bread goes up. And the price of bread goes up because the price of grain goes up. And we can't begin to understand how important that was in pre-industrial societies, the price of grain going up, right? Bread was a huge part of our nutrition, right? They thought, okay. So what happens? Well, women, they're food riots, right? About the price of grain going up. This is like the conspiracy theory, right? And the screaming was the monopolists have raised the price of grain. And they'd use the term monopolist. Monopolist was that was like the worst thing you could say about somebody, was to call them a monopolist. And it was sort of, what more specifically was it, say, in modern antitrust terms? Well, it was hoarding, okay? Not really price fixing, a cartel, because they weren't complaining so much about an agreement to fix prices, right? That's sort of part of it, but it was more vaguer. The prices went up and they, the monopolists, usually resellers, right? It's the evil middlemen, right? Okay. They bought grain off the market, and then they've held it off the market until the price, to keep the price going up, right? So that led to, it's vague in the sense of, compared to modern law, on exactly what the unlawful conduct is, right? But it was very powerful. I mean, a very, very powerful complaint. It leads to riots, leads to changes of governments. I mean, it was very serious, right? Far more violent than today's discussions of price fixing, right?
Absolutely. I would maybe like to touch on that afterwards, how we have evolved in that way, because although we have huge discussions right now, I think things have definitely evolved. So on the first kind of monopoly, is it right to say that it were more monopolistic practices perceived as raising prices?
Yes. It's basically a monopoly was a quote monopolistic end of quote practice. And with that, yeah. What do you mean monopolistic practice? It was a practice that raised prices. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. It's very vague. That in law, in European law, and it ends up in American law, that led to laws against forestalling and hoarding. Forestalling they're hoarding. You find them in other societies too. The Chinese, a lot of laws on hoarding, right? At any rate, forestalling was again, it's the evil middleman, right? Who became a hero in modern economics, right? But what forestalling was the farmer produced the grain, and what you wanted to happen was the farmer then took the grain to the town market. A forestaller went and bought the grain, not at the town market, but bought the grain directly from the farmer, and then held it for a while to resell it. So it was forestalling the market. It was intervening. It was buying into a market. Okay, earlier, so it wasn't okay. And the colonials had that law. Virginia has all kinds of interesting laws. case got it. In Virginia, the first settlements for stalling laws were the ship, the grain, they weren't growing anything, right? So a lot, well, that's an exaggeration. A lot of the goods necessary to these handful of settlers in Virginia, they had to import. So imports were critically important, right? They didn't have iron products earlier, right? So the forestalling laws prohibited somebody, the ships were all coming into one port in Virginia, right? And forestaller would get to the ship before it landed and buy goods off the ship. So the law said, you're not supposed to do that. The ship has the goods. The ship is supposed to land at this one port, this designated port, Jamestown, right? It doesn't matter, Norfolk. And then sells the goods from the ship in the port. Okay, so that's one example. They had very serious laws about this, right? I mean, they had serious enforcement for decades. So forestalling was one example of a law that rested on this vaguer notion of monopolistic practices that raised prices, because the idea was these forestallers were causing price increases. Okay.
That sounds familiar with some practices that are still nowadays we witness, at least in countries like Argentina. But anyway, so it's interesting.
No, it is. All right. So during the colonial period and up through the revolutionary period, this notion of monopolistic practice, which is condemned, and that condemnation is reflected primarily in, they didn't have laws against monopolies. It was reflected in laws against forestalling and hoarding. Okay, that complaint goes through the revolutionary period. George Washington was making speeches about the horrible monopolists or raising the prices of food. Okay, so you get this. So through the colonial period, during the American Revolution, you've got, you know, important political figures like George Washington condemning monopolists as forestallers, right? Then you begin to see people saying, whoa, 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 like Benjamin Franklin, right? He was the version of the economist today, but he's not alone, saying, whoa, 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 this isn't, it's not necessarily a bad thing, these middlemen, right? I mean, they're redistributing goods, blah, blah, blah. The modern economics, modern economists would say forestalling is a good thing, right? It's an efficient, blah, 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 right? So you get arguments like that about, well, this is not a bad thing. It's more efficient to do this, right? So the laws against forestalling are criticized even as early as the revolutionary period, okay? Then in the 19th century, they begin to, in the antebellum period before the Civil War, they're increasingly less enforced because there's more economics arguments, more economy, you know, saying, look, these are not a bad thing. You get into the modern period, forestalling is, there are actually cases on this. You have laws against forestalling still banned under, you know, still exist under state law. I found some cases. Every once in a while, somebody, some imaginative lawyer finds, hey, I have a statute, right? But by and large, they have been, they've been overpowered by the Sherman Act, modern antitrust law, and you do have decisions under the modern antitrust law throughout the period saying we're not against forestalling anymore. Forestalling is can be an economic good thing. And the U.S. antitrust laws do not prohibit forestalling. So, you know, if you had to say what the law is in the U.S. today, forestalling and this notion of a monopolistic practice has pretty much disappeared. Okay, so that's monopolistic practice. Monopoly is a monopolistic classic price gouging. The other concept, when you say monopoly, was a government grant of exclusive privileges. This was. Remember, if you have to pick who's the representative who's screaming about monopolistic practice, it's your mother who is rioting because the price of grain's going up. She can't feed the family. Okay, that's the typical. Okay. the typical complainant about exclusive trading provisions, you know, granted by the government, that's a competitor. That's somebody who's been excluded. So you and when the first settlements in your first decade of the 17th century, that's just the period. Remember, these are English settlements, except for the Netherlands, except for the Dutch, right? New York, right? That's just the time where England is developing an anti-monopoly, a legal anti-monopoly principle, right? Which gets support, and they'll make a big thing about it, and they don't show the publication. But the U.S., the Americans went way beyond the English, because the English ultimately say, look, the anti-monopoly principle is, it starts with Queen Elizabeth granting an exclusive trading privilege in playing cards, right? So the law ended up being, the English law was they were complaining about arbitrary royal grants. Well, you could have reasonable royal grants. So there was a reasonable monopoly that was not unlawful. And the anti-monopoly principle, the English anti-monopoly, did not apply to the parliament. That was the queen or the king, right? Okay. Yeah. The Americans go further. The Americans take this abstract anti-monopoly principle and start applying it they apply it locally. So you've got, I mean, great stuff of the Massachusetts Bay Colony would grant an exclusive trading privilege for important sectors, say fur trading, or more generally trading with the Indians. Okay. Well, and somebody else say, whoa, that's exclusive. Well, we don't like that, right? So you've got a lot of this. So you've got, during the entire colonial period, you will have both England granting the big, horrible, you know, which one caused the American Revolution, England granting exclusive trading privileges to the East India Trading Company, that ended up getting a tea monopoly, which was one reason for the Boston Tea Party, which is actually named in the Declaration of Independence as one of the causes for independence, was these exclusive monopolies, right? So it was turn there. The second was a government-granted monopoly, and that monopoly, in quotes, was a government-granted exclusive trading privileges, maybe only for a certain period of time. That was probably the most powerful anti-monopoly concept during the colonial period, okay? Directed against both the major English trading monopolies and plenty of examples of this, granted again action against local or colonial administrations granted various local monopolies. And again, this is where I found fascinating stuff in these histories of different states with great stories of, you know, hypocritical stories. You get an exclusive and I complain about it. And I'd break up your exclusivity. Maybe I'd bribe somebody to break up your exclusivity. It's all government granted, right? Well, is that, what did we do about monopoly before 1890, which was the beginning of the Sherman Act? So that's what this book is about. And I go back to the idea of America here, my apologies to the Spanish, is the America that led to the United States. Well, the America that led to the United States were primarily the English and Dutch settlements on the East Coast. Okay, so I start, I look at just in a way, there's the matrix here. I have four periods of American history. And in each period, I look at three very, very different concepts of a monopoly, of how it was used, okay? And I show that, and I was surprised by this myself, right? I didn't start this with any agenda, right? I just, like history, I'll just try to get as much as you can an accurate idea of what was in fact happening, okay, fine.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, just before we get into the details of the book, I was sort of interested to know if there was any let's say, relationship with your previous book that you finally, I think it was published in August, October 2020. We had just 3 years ago a very interesting conversation with the IDC when you were almost presenting your book on antitrust competition laws. Did that research on that previous book had any effect on any, was there any cause why you decided to write on monopoly in the US?
Yes, in a sense, this book is a follow-on. The prior book I looked at, I had a chapter on competition laws around the world before the Sherman Act, before 1890, right? In that chapter, now this is going back thousands of years, because I found things that look something like modern antitrust or competition laws in ancient societies. Okay, fine. And that included laws that I found a lot of laws that would look nothing like modern antitrust laws, right? Okay, but they dealt with so-called monopolies, right? And I had a very brief description of it, because again, in the United States, when you talk about a monopoly before 1890, you talk about the common law, that's only England. There's a lot more going on in the world in the last 4,000 years than what happened in England, right? So that got me interested. And then I thought, well, I think I'll just look at monopoly. I did not in that book. I also had a chapter on the United States antitrust laws, but that was almost from 1890 forward. So there was sort of a gap in that book. There was some discussion of monopoly outside the United States before 1890, and there was discussion of monopoly under the modern antitrust laws in the United States, but I had nothing about what was monopoly in the United States before 1890. That's how I got into it. And to my surprise, I found that there was, there's evidence. We all, Americans, the initial settlers, initially were against monopoly, okay, in a certain sense, okay, right? And that surprised me. Who would be interested in this book? Well, if you're interested in history, you should be interested in this. Does it have any relevance or use to a practicing lawyer? Well, yes, if you're in a case where someone is using history, particularly an opponent. So the opponent cites, and best example here would be you're in only U.S. law, but it could be other law too, right? But U.S. antitrust law, there's a dispute about patentability or intellectual property rights, particularly copyrights. What's the scope of a patent? What's the scope of a copyright? And there are Supreme Court decisions on this. And it's common for the people who are challenging the patent or copyright to cite particularly Thomas Jefferson, who's got, he condemned patent monopolies and copyrights as horrible, whatever. Win it if you want, right? Well, if you read this book, you are better equipped to challenge that. Say, well, yes, you can find a statement from Thomas Jefferson condemning patents as monopolies and we shouldn't have anybody. But you can also find that, you've got a number of things. Number one, Jefferson modifies his opinion, okay? His initial, the language where he's really condemning monopoly and patent monopolies, not in a technical sense, just he doesn't want patents, right? As a good American in 1789, you're against monopoly, right? When he's saying these statements, more specifically, he's condemning the patent provision in the U.S. Constitution, which expressly accepts patents and, I'll say, copyrights, that kind of intellectual property, as, an exception to this anti-monopoly principle. So we've got a provision in the Constitution. He attacks that. So we shouldn't have a provision in the Constitution, right? Well, you know, a little history. Yeah. That's interesting, Thomas Jefferson saying that. Of course, the Constitution is proposed, it's drafted, and proposed in Philadelphia in 1788. Then they put it up for a vote. Thomas Jefferson is criticizing it in Paris where he's the ambassador. He wasn't in the Constitutional Convention. All right, so he's a famous figure, but he was not directly part of the legislative history. And then more importantly, he modifies his views. In fact, he becomes head of the patent department. In the first administration, he starts reviewing patents. He says, well, gee, I mean, some of these patents are pretty good, right? Okay, fine. So, and then you have a lot of other founders, serious founders, right, for this, like James Madison, who do not, who accept the Constitutional Provision on patents. And you then can find a lot of other statements. People saying, yes, we are against monopolies. And I'll get into what do they mean by that. But they say, but no matter how you define a monopoly, we're not against patents. We recognize as an exception to the anti-monopoly principle patents, inventions.
Sorry, you mentioned that some judges and lawyers have been known on occasion to use history in ways that would disturb professional historians. And some sort of isolated sentences from the writings of a historical figure is quoted to support maybe an argument or legal position. And then this is often done with no little or no broader historical context. And so you were talking about that. And in your book, I think you also mentioned that mindful of those sentiments, you pressed on. Do you want to get more into the details of that? Why you chose that path?
Well, yeah, let me just, and then we'll move to, and the best example of that in the book, which I ended up spending a lot of time on, is on the patent. The United States Constitution accepts or provides that Congress can grant exclusive patent rights or rights for inventions and author's rights. So it takes, there is no, in the federal constitution, there is no general anti-monopoly provision. There are state constitutions, but not in the federal constitution. So the only thing that directly talks about a monopoly in the constitution is a provision providing for patents and copyrights, right? And in the arguments about the length of a copyright, a term, length of a copyright, that was a big case. You know, can Disney get a copyright for a million? No, not a million years, but an extended time for Mickey Mouse and this kind of thing. So you've had Supreme Court decisions on patents and copyrights, and in those Supreme Court decisions, the justices who are want to limit the scope of the patent or copyright, they cite history to say, well, Mayor, we don't like monopolies, so we should interpret the Constitution provision or any statute under the Constitution provision, we should interpret it narrowly because we're against monopolies. And that's bad history, right? Or it's overlooked history, right? So just as that's an area that frankly I didn't know anything about before I started writing the book. But that's probably the best example of the usefulness of history and the book in the actual practice of the law, right? I mean, you could help your client in litigation if you knew some more history. Okay, that's just one example. The misuse of history, and there's misuse of history in other areas of the law, right? In U.S. law, but antitrust is sort of interesting. That's the best example, right? But what I Absolutely. So what. So I got.
No, sorry. Go ahead. So,
yeah, I got interested in monopoly in the United States before the Sherman Act because it was not covered in the prior book, and that's what got me into it. And once I got into it, I found wow, there's a lot of number one, we've had three very different ideas of what is monopoly. Two, there's significant evidence that we've always been against monopoly. You can find tremendous, if you want to write a brief saying you've got to show that there's always been a policy, a political and a popular policy against monopoly, you can find plenty of historical examples in American history. All right, now, what I've done in a way is I take four different periods of American history and I look at three concepts of monopoly in each of these periods. And you see then very clearly that there are, and I'll look at each concept, some of the concepts change, some disappear. It's not really, they're not, one is not particularly relevant today. Others really didn't appear in the early part of our history, like the present economics definition of a monopolist is somebody with market power, so the Aristotelian definition, right? Well, that wasn't really, that is not what people meant, except maybe a couple of philosophers, right, about monopoly. So the three concepts of monopoly vary over time. In the different periods, and quickly the three periods, and these make sense historically, but they also make sense for monopoly, is you start, say, in 1600. The first settlement is in Virginia, the Virginia settlement, around 1610 roughly, but they start trying to raise money for it in 1600s, right? So the first period, 1600 to the 1760s, which is the beginning of the American Revolutionary period. That's 10 years before, but that doesn't matter. So then the Revolutionary period is formed from, say, roughly in the 1760s until 1789, which is the beginning of the United States, okay, right? Well, form of government. And then the third period is the antebellum period from 1789 until the Civil War. It ends in 1865. And the fourth period is everything after 1865 to the present. It's not. So you've got the colonial period until the revolution, the revolutionary formation period, which is only about 25 years, the antebellum period, which is mostly the early part of the 19th century, and then the modern period, which is the late 19th century, beginning with the antitrust movement up to the present. Okay, so you look at those four periods, and then you look at the three very different concepts of monopoly. And I'll start with the sort of what was more important historically. The first period, very quickly, one wasn't monopoly. The concept was more monopolists, and it's the conspiracy. Yeah.
I mean, I studied the London School of Economics, in where we say that we want to know the causes of things. So in the process of going through all those four periods that you've just mentioned, and before we get into the details of those periods, I imagine you may have read during the research thousands and thousands of pages. How many, for example, I don't know, if you read a book of 500 pages on the history of whatever in the US, how many of those pages were actually directly or indirectly involved in your research on monopolies or monopolistic practices or all those kinds of practices in the US?
Okay, that's a really good question. Okay, one is, I'm my mother used to say, I'm a garbage reader. I read a lot. Right. If you send me things, I will read it. Right. Okay. Right. So I like to read. Right. I'm also supposed to be retired, which means I work all the time, but nobody pays me anything. Right. So if you work all the time, you have a lot of time to read. So I read hundreds of books, probably 1,000 articles. I have a very extensive bibliography. Right. So I read an enormous amount of material. With electronics, you can do it fast. I mean, electronics permits you to get access to massive amounts of material very quickly. It doesn't, you still have to read it, right? Okay, which is fun. But the access is, because I could not have read all this material before it was digitized, right? Or before the digital searching, right? And I won't bore, but I had a great relationship with the library at Fordham Law School Library, and two guys there, and blah, 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 right? So you get access to literally tens of thousands of pages, right? And that's what I did. I just kept reading all that stuff. Then say, on the colonial period, what I found is a really good example. There would be, you'd find an old, in the 19th century, the late 19th century, you found a lot of histories of states written by people. People get it. So you have the history of New Hampshire, the history of the state of New York, history, et cetera, right? And there's a lot of them published in the 19th century for some reason, right? So these are histories, say in the case of New York was mostly Dutch, right? Starts out as Dutch, right? They would start at some point in the early 17th century, and they would go into the maybe the early 19th century. So it was mostly the Cultural Revolutionary period. Then say the history of New York, okay? I could find that there was no one talking about monopoly. That was rare. There wouldn't be, there would not, those would have been wonderful. There was no chapter on monopoly. You had to sort of read everything, looking for more, well, once you caught on what to be looking for, then you could get, you know, certain kind of companies, but they weren't companies really. Fur trading, price gouging, prices, riots, food riots, okay? But so in other words, if there were a 300-page book, which probably was, on the state of New York, buried in that book, sometimes you could find it through the index. But most times, no, there wasn't some index that said monopoly. That, you know, that would have been one, right? No, you just
That means a huge effort and concentration on your side, because you might be reading a book or written by a historian that has maybe not a lot of idea on what antitrust or competition law is, but while you were reading those 300 pages, maybe you saw some sorts of conduct, as you've mentioned, and from there you constructed. So I'm sort of interested in the process of what's Barry Hawkes' method. We need to have a method when you write whatever you write. So your method would be, I read, as you said, garbage, thousands of pages, now help with the electronics, and from there you got to this sort of 230 pages of this new book, in the sense of, I think it's what I want to get into. I mean, your effort in a certain way in this book, and when we try to understand the causes of things and the history of why we are where we are now, I think this should be a huge effort, and it's also hugely valuable, because I don't imagine also an antitrust practitioner or an academic, reading those many books. So in a certain way, your book in that sense helps a lot to understand why we are where we are in the US, not since 1890 with the Sherman Act, but much even before that.
Well, I like to think that's one value of the book. I mean, you had somebody like me who maybe has had the time, is a little crazy, likes history. I like reading, you know, spending days on you can read fast, right? Because at some point you began to see patterns. You began to see there were sectors that got more right. Fur trading in New England, right? Okay, well, people were trading furs. Frequently there you would find exclusive trading rights, which was monopoly, right? Okay, so you learn while they may not have used, or nobody indexed the word monopoly, you gradually learned where there was going to be better sources of what you were talking about. But when I started out, it was true. I didn't know what I was going to find, right? Clearly in the colonial period, no one's writing about this, really. So yes, one, I would hope, value of the book was somebody went through all this totally different kinds of things. Just like, so the history of New York would not refer to the history of South Carolina. That was another interesting thing. I'm not going to do this, but you could have, and other subjects, and compare colonial histories of different states, right? But I didn't do that. I just looked at monopoly, right? But yes, the method was, I ended up, all right, if I'm really going to understand what's going on, and again, try to get a feel, you know, you gotta immerse yourself. You gotta get a feel of the period. Extremely hard to do if somebody's a couple hundred years old, right? But anyway, that was my justification for spending all this time initially. But I really didn't know what I was going to find, right? Then I began finding things, right? And what we're now, the process here it was very important for the colonial period because I never really found anything. I never found a book. I can't remember now. Maybe I'm being, I didn't find a full article on, say, monopoly in the colonial period, which is almost 2 years, right? Okay. Or even during the revolutionary period, okay, that 25-year period. You begin getting books on articles, more in-depth discussion, say, of the 19th century, because now we're getting closer to the Sherman Act, right? And it is the United States now, so you've got case law, federal courts, what have you, right? But none of that existed. So yes, it's, let's say if you were trying to look at what's more creative here, what's new, certainly as far as historical research goes, the newer part would be the, from 1600 to after the Civil War, that part. But that's interesting what you're asking, because that was a surprise to me. I didn't know if I'd find anything about colonial America, going back before the American Revolution. And I did, and part of what I did was I ended up with three concepts of monopoly. And only one of them is what we use today, right? So if I had said, no, the only one that counts, and I'm a good economist, American mainstream economist, or antitrust lawyer, mainstream antitrust lawyer, right? Then the only concept of monopoly is actually the oldest, Aristotle's concept of monopoly, which is a single thing, right? Okay, that idea, that economics notion of a monopoly as a single seller, that's the latest concept in American history, and that wasn't nearly as important until the Sherman Act. Okay, so it's only in the modern period and the present, that we use the term monopoly in this defined as this economic concept.
I don't want to spoil your book so that everyone reads it, but I mean, trying to make it clear again for the audience. So these three kinds of monopolies from a historical perspective, again, one, the first one you mentioned, monopolistic practices perceived as raising prices. The second that you've just mentioned, this sort of government grants of monopoly or exclusive privileges. And there's a third one, I think it brings us to this more sort of modern economic sense of private firms monopolies. So where do you see that difference from the second concept to the third one?
Okay, well, let me finish the second one because that leads to the third. So you've got, I was surprised. I mean, I'm surprised because I didn't know anyone when I started, right? The seriousness, the passion of this anti-government monopoly sentiment in the United States, right? It's a driving force earlier during the colonial period, during the revolution. It continues into the antebellum period. So it continues into the 19th century. And Jackson, President Jackson, Andrew Jackson, who's sort of a democratic hero, this is a lot of irony, right? He gets into a big fight with what's called the Second Bank of the United States, which was sort of a private central bank that gets created in the 1816, 1817, right? So Jackson doesn't like this, right? And says this is a private bank in Philadelphia. These Eastern bankers are getting rich. Jackson was our first non-elitist, if you will, Western president. Okay, fine, right? Anyway, he gets into a fight and he essentially kills the Second Bank of the United States. And that's the big, as giving government privileges. So he uses this anti-monopoly principle that goes back to right from the beginning. I mean, you've got in 1610, at the Virginia settlement, people are complaining about the first Virginia company granting exclusive trading privileges to the company. Okay, right in 1610, right? So, all right. So Jackson, 200 years later, destroys the United States' first central bank, kills off a central bank really until the 20th century. We couldn't have another central bank, right? Bankers hate this, right? Okay. And he does that with his anti, it's a monopoly, meaning a government monopoly. Okay, fine. Then what happens? Well, a couple of things happen. Economics again, you get a lot of, I'm simplifying, but what happened in the United States to this anti-government monopoly principle economically, you got increasing economic justifications for government monopolies. I'm really oversimplifying, but one idea was the idea of natural monopoly. Now, people heard of a natural monopoly before the 19th century, but modern economists refined that concept. So you get economists saying, look, there's certain kind of monopolies that you're always going to have, and that you can't do anything about that. You regulate them. You regulate their rates. You regulate entry, and you have the government own them, right? Or the government will grant a monopoly to somebody, right? So some government monopolies now have an economics justification. And then politically, they sort of go together. People who say don't know anything about economics just decide, we like government intervention in the market. Big government doesn't scare me. I like big government, right? I don't like the market. I'm overwhelmed. I'm being a little, but okay. You on the political side, you've got a greater acceptance of government regulation and intervention in the market. Well, that's counter to this old, when you read the colonials, they'd have been shocked, right? They didn't want governments granting exclusive trading privileges. They also would have been shocked at the size of governments, right? Mm. And I'm not right or wrong. That's what happened. So this anti-government principle that was very strong, it was stronger than the monopolistic practice principle, right? That ends up gradually disappearing. And it disappears by the 20th century. I mean, you look at the modern antitrust laws, U.S. antitrust laws are far weaker than European antitrust or competition laws with respect to government monopolies and competition. We're very weak on them. We're extremely accepted. It's very easy to eliminate the application of the U.S. antitrust laws, which are focused almost entirely on private antitrust, which goes to the third thing. So there's, and I'm not saying it's good or bad, but when you look at history, wow, the thing that we were most concerned about, government grants of monopoly and exclusive trading privileges, actually that's disappeared. We don't care about that anymore. We have a new law. The new law is concerned about private firms and large private firms. Okay, so that's a whole new thing. This gets fascinating from because now we're up to the present. I mean, 1890 starts the present. Okay. Mm. So what happened? Stop me here because this is out. This is also fascinating. Your first two monopoly concepts, the forestalling monopolistic practice. There again, if you want to blame this on economists, blame it on the economists. They said, well, it's a good thing. You're really complaining about a middleman. There is no such thing as price manipulation. That's a phony concept, or it shouldn't be. You shouldn't have a law against it unless somebody's misrepresenting or it's a lot false or something, right? So economists, all of economics is pretty much eliminating or eroding the concept of monopolistic practices as price increases. The government grants of monopoly privilege, exclusive trading privileges, that's disappeared for economics reasons, more technical economics reasons. It's disappeared for general political acceptance, social acceptance, what have you, of big government and market intervention. Okay. So then we get a new, well, it's not new, it's Aristotle's. And it says it's older than monopolies. In fact, Aristotle said monopoly. As we know, right? We're saying monopoly. So it's Greek, right? Okay, right. So you know it's back to as many, if not most interesting things. You trace it back to the Greeks, right? So it's a single seller. We go back to single seller. It's that concept. You had references to that before 1890. People had read Aristotle before 1890. So I'm not saying no one ever thought of monopoly as single seller before 1890. It was a concept, but it becomes of single importance. It's the only important concept after in the modern period. Why? Well, not so much that everybody became an economist. Well, that's part of it. That is part of it. This goes into the history of, and this is, it starts with the US, but it's ended up around the world, okay? What happened in the US, this is my take on what happened in 1890, because there are books on the legislative history, the Sherman Act and the debates in the Senate and the House are so, people are saying so many different things that you can make almost any argument for based on legislative history, except probably for consumer welfare. That's completely crazy to argue that consumer welfare, use that term, was didn't exist in 1889, right? Okay, right, as such, or when the Congress. But putting that aside, here's Barry Hawke's take on the Sherman Act, 1890. Starting in the 1870s, there's a tremendous popular movement against the new large firms, and you get state laws. So you've got state laws that are being enforced, okay? And what is the concern? And it's a popular concern. It's populist, it's popular, right? It's not an elitist concern, only an elitist concern, right? It's the size of the large firms, because the firms at this point are dwarfing probably anything in history. Okay, and you can find some exceptions, something one firm, but not overall, right? Okay, and there's a huge movement against this, right? For political reasons, saying they're influencing the government, they are getting preferential treatment from governments, either through corruption or just influence of the state legislatures, say for special rates, right? So it's very specific allegations of political interference, not some vague, you know, academic thing, right? They're social, saying, you know, we don't have control over our local businesses and employment anymore. Somebody's sitting in the evil northeast of the United States is bankers again, right? They're making decisions, and they close the plant, and they do all this stuff, right? So there's a social dislocation, okay? Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of the economics kinds of thing. There are references to prices, okay? But that's only one part of the mix. When you start getting a feel for everything, all the editorials won't have you, it's sure not consumer welfare by itself, right? Okay, fine. Mm. So somebody's saying, one thing, what do you do about these firms that have some of the really big firms are using the trust device as a legal device to agglomerate different businesses and take over competitors or control competitors controlling each other or getting together, right? So that's why, okay, we got to stop the trusts. That's why it's antitrust, right? So that is a business organization. What I think happened was you Congress decides you got state laws now for 10 years. You're getting, we got to do something, okay, at the federal level, okay? And what are we going to do? Well, one idea was to have a federal incorporation statute. A lot of objections to that, particularly from this business. My guess is what happens. First, they decide they got to do something. Then what are we going to do? Well, we want a federal incorporation statute. We're going to have more votes let's just have we'll call it an antitrust law because we're going to have it against the trusts as a form of business. But we'll just, you know, we've always been against monopolies and for competition. Well, they didn't. We've always been for against monopolies. So we'll just pass a law that's based on all these old common law principles, and we'll just pass a very broad, vague, general law, which it is.
Leave it to the courts.
Leave it to the courts, right? And the United States Congress has done that frequently in American history. This is not the only time. We got a problem, we don't know how the hell to deal with this. So we'll just give it to the courts. Gave it to the courts. Then what happened was there wasn't any clear. What the courts did was they did use the common law, but they didn't take the common law substantive law, which was too unclear. The English common law by the end of the 19th century was almost pro-cartel. Well, they don't want to do that, right? Okay, they didn't like that. So they didn't like contemporary English common law. The English anti-monopoly law was very weak at this point, right? So they didn't really adopt, and you get endless arguments about what is English common law. You want to write, 17th century English common law, medieval English common law, fine, right? So what the courts didn't look to, the English, we've been doing this, right? But they weren't really doing that. That was all rhetoric. They didn't look to specific substantive rules at English common law at some period in English history. They just said, with English common law means that the courts decide what the law is. Well, that's what we'll do. And the law, you just adapt the law to changing conditions. That's what they do, and that's what they did, right? Okay. Now, here's my, the Congress bucks the decision to the courts under a very broad variety of concerns, including political and social concerns, right? The courts then say, we're going to adapt the law to conditions. Now, this, I think, is critically important. It's hard to get at. It probably should be a separate book, but I'm probably not going to write, right? Here's what I think happens. When you economics takes over, why? Well, I'm not paranoid enough to be, I'm not a big believer in conspiracy theories. I think it's just the other explanations, right? Well, it's not that the judges got together and decided we're going to eliminate economic and social concerns, because you still get references up until the 60s. You get wonderful references to the, we want deconcentrate, we want small operators for political and social reasons. Okay, right? Hell with efficiency. Okay, what happens? In litigation, not in making speeches, not in writing academic books, here's my enforcement policy, right? Formulating policy, but in deciding cases, in litigation, you've got to settle a dispute. You got two sides. And I think what happened was, okay, you've got very vague legal standards. What is a restraint of trade, right? We didn't even use the word competition, right? What is monopolized? These are extremely vague. What's that? You look to different disciplines to provide answers. And it does, what we are talking about is an economic activity. So economics provided the most direct and arguably the clearest, we can say the only relevant help to a court, and more importantly, to the judge, to the lawyers. So you're a lawyer representing a plaintiff. What's your job? To marshal the facts and develop legal theories, and you put those two things together in doing your work. Okay, right? You got to get facts. You got legal theories. The theories that you're developing affect what facts you're marshaling. Blah blah blah. Right? Good lawyer. You're always playing with theories and facts, right? To produce your case. Well, on the theory side. The most relevant source of theory to decide what is a restraint of trade, or more interesting, what is a monopoly, right, is going to be economics, not political theory or political, looking at disciplines, okay? And so economics was not only more relevant, it was more useful because it was more relevant. And that's, to me, it's gradually over the years, it's over 125 years now, and it accelerates in the 70s. Economics not only becomes predominant, it becomes, economics as a discipline becomes the exclusive, if you don't like the word standard, it becomes the exclusive source of theories to decide whether or not something is lawful or unlawful under the antitrust laws.
So, Barry, let me zoom there because this, I find this very interesting, because in your book, you mentioned that cooperation and not competition was the aim of U.S. Economic policy during Roosevelt's first term. Then in 1933, there was the pragmatic president reversed that policy. Then we reached Alcoa, the breakup of AT&T, that was viewed by many observers as generating decades of consumer benefits with new entrants and new numerous opportunities for new competition. And then we reached the 70s that you've just mentioned. And beginning in the late 1970s, you said in your book that antitrust law was retrenched. Government challenges to monopoly were spare between 1980 until recently, 2020. Certainly, when compared with the trust-busting and post-war expansionary periods, you mentioned the only important exception, the Microsoft case in the 90s. How do you see that? I mean, the current situation and what happened in the U.S. between 1970 until recently. And if we will see definitely a substantial change in the U.S. because everything we've seen at least since 2020 until now with the new administration in the U.S. is mainly sort of administrative efforts. But we still have to see how things evolve in the at the courts in the states. So what are, if any, your thoughts on this process from the 1970s onwards?
Let me caveat here what I'm saying, in that I tend to overdo or maybe categorize too much the economics from the politics, right? Or economic concerns. Okay, so that's a caveat to the listening, right? Okay. On the economic side, antitrust has always been, antitrust law, U.S. again, it's always been affected by developments in economic theory. Okay, from the beginning. I mean, you didn't have good cartel theory in 1890, but cartels have always been condemned almost throughout the world until the English suddenly decide they like cartels in the 19th century. And that's a different thing. And then economic theory develops, and you can see different developments in economic theory having different effects on antitrust law. So that on the economic side, it's dramatic in cartels and in these kinds of agreements. It's economic theory that provides more support for tougher cartel enforcement. On the merger side, and also on the monopoly side, you get a economic schools begin to emphasize in the 50s, begin emphasizing concentration, that the concentration, economic concentration leads to a bad performance, i.e. let's say higher prices, to oversimplify. So if you find concentrated markets, you will find higher prices. We don't want higher prices. Everybody agrees on that. Most of the time, and that's the concentration theory in the 50s, and that clearly those cited. I mean that influences early 60s Supreme Court decisions where we are condemning vertical mergers with market shares under 10%. I mean that's inconceivable for them. Okay, we're condemning horizontal mergers of a couple of percent. Okay, now. Then again, just staying with economics, in the 70s, people economists begin to challenging the concentration theorists and say, whoa, you're wrong. Concentration by itself, one, you don't know how to define it. You're doing this and that, academic models, which bear no relationship to reality. Two, even assuming you can define concentration, it does not necessarily lead to bad performance, right? Science concentration improves innovation, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So then there's a whole movement in economists against concentration, or against the concentration theories. They get the majority of economists. So the mainstream economists, if the court were looking to the sources now, economists are saying, well, you should not be condemning vertical mergers of 10% or horizontal mergers of 5%. That's crazy. Right? And then in addition to the theories about concentration, which is not Chicago school, right? I think too much is made of Chicago school. Then you have a group of people who are also saying antitrust is missing out on efficiencies. You've exaggerated not just concentration theory, but you're doing other crazy stuff. And you're not paying enough attention to efficiencies. You're looking at other concerns. Your concern should be prices, or at least prices and output. I say output, but very difficult measuring effects on output. So you should be measuring effect on prices. That's what we're going to simplify this whole complicated antitrust system you lawyers have created. It's going to make an easy test. Prices. What's the effect? Just ask what's the effect on prices. You know whether something's lawful or not. Well, that's part of the Chicago school. They would add what I call legal process reasons, justifications, or rationales for that. You're going to have to predict. If the only thing you look to is effect on prices, you're going to have predictable legal rules, you're going to have certainty, blah, 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 right? So there's a whole set of interesting, not frivolous at all, justifications, reasons to narrow the antitrust laws by focusing only on certain economic factors, which we're going to wrap up in the big term consumer welfare. That was a great ad man thing. Bork says consumer welfare. It's got the word consumer in there. And I don't know. Okay. So what is all this done? Well, what I'm saying is you had a change in the law, and there's a lot more specifics where you can show the effect of a development of an economic theory on specific antitrust monopoly issues of say tying arrangements, leveraging, what have you, right? And you can see it in the court decisions. Okay, so that's all economics. So economics has continued. Developments in economic theory have always influenced antitrust law to varying degrees. Now they're even more important because it looks like the only thing we're looking at anymore is economics. And then when you look at, well, what's happened since 2020? If I'm putting aside non-economics, it's the politics, which can also be important, is from an economics point of view, you do have economists now within the economics profession, people who are developing economic theories. They don't go back. Some of them try to go back to the pure concentration people. They probably don't even know it, right? They're not reading, right? But you know, it's Carl Kaysen in the 50s all over again, right? But some of it's newer stuff of developments of potential competition through blah, 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 right? To show, really try to show that no, certain kinds of birds like killer acquisitions, while they may not raise prices in the short run in a well-defined market, nonetheless are stifling innovation in the long run, blah, blah, blah. A lot of this short-term, long-term. I mean, that is your quick thing as a practicing lawyer looking at any economic theory is, how much is this short term or long term? Because Keynes was right. I can come up with any kind of a theory that will work in the long run. All right. So the longer run your theory is, the more suspect that it's in, right. Doesn't mean it's wrong, but the more skeptical. Okay, fine. So you're getting economic theories that could be used in litigation to support tougher monopoly and certainly merger enforcement. My guess is there's more work being, it's a guess now, I'm not keep up enough of this. My guess is that there's more economics work being done on merger theory, the anti-competitive effects of mergers than there is on monopolies, right? Okay. That's because monopolies raise a problem that nothing else raises like this in antitrust, and that's the, unless you're going to condemn all monopolies, first you got to define what's a monopoly, right? So if you agree on what is monopoly, you either condemn everything that's a monopoly, or you have to decide what's a good or bad monopoly, what's a lawful or unlawful monopoly, well, whatever set of adjectives you like. That's extremely hard to do. That was avoided in American history until the Sherman Act. Because in, when they were screaming about, they were very much against government grants monopoly. Government grants monopoly were per se unlawful. The remedy was easy. You stop the government. You ask the government or the local council, whatever it was, terminate the exclusive trading privileges. See, okay? If it's a private monopoly, and you've got language about it, it's very rare, but you can find language. It's very rare because it wasn't a problem, right? Whereas a company would get a monopoly. They were selling everything, and somebody complained about it. And there's actually a wonderful Pennsylvania decision before the Civil War that sounds like a modern so-called Chicago School decision to say, wait a second, plaintiff, are you saying that the defendant here, they should be condemned simply because they got successful? We don't do that. We built the country on people working hard and competing hard to be successful. And why do you do that? Because if you're successful, you make money. So there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's wacko to say that somebody who's successful should be penalized, right? Okay, which is what people say to me, right? Okay. That's a monopoly per se. Well, when the concern was government grants a monopoly, you didn't have this conundrum of trying to distinguish a good or bad monopoly, right? So that's a modern problem, right? Now, that economics tries to solve it, and the law tries to solve it or narrow the problem by providing clear legal rules about certain kinds of practices, like say predatory pricing. Sure. I'll leave it to you and the audience to decide whether, or a client, more importantly than an economist or any lawyer, right? What is, does a business, do they think they've got a clear legal rule on pricing? If they ask their lawyer, what is the legal rule on predatory pricing? When does my pricing get too low that it's unlawful? I throw that out, okay? But the rules on predatory pricing are given as an example of the good thing that economists and lawyers have done on creating predictable, transparent legal rules under monopolization. If you're skeptical about that, then you're real skeptical about the whole thing. Right? This whole thing is very vague, right? Okay. Now, that's all on the economist side. And I'll stop on economics, beating up your economist. If you think that economics is this wonderful, you know, it's like the natural sciences, which it sure is not, you know, it's wacko, right? And it provides, you put in the data and you get algorithmic answers. No. And if you believe that economics provides algorithmic answers and therefore we just, you know, fine. All you have to do is read the Amex decision, the American Amex decision, where it's a five-way decision. They both read economics. They both use economic models. They both use the majority. And they come out totally, completely opposite ways. And that makes one, well, you can't believe in an algorithmic natural science of economics when you read that opinion, because it's clear that what was critical in that, one thing that was critical in that decision was the selection of the economic models, not algorithmic execution of an economic model, right? Okay, fine. I'm being too, I mean, you need economists, and they are the most useful, but okay. Now, in addition to, so what's happening now? Well, on a little more, let's go to the, if the people, if Lena Khan and everybody else, if the challengers, okay, the people who, you know, let's get the politics. Why are we being told by Lena Khan? That's because of politics, not because of economic theory. Because Biden won the election, right? This is economics, that politics are important. We're not talking about this, right? But it is. So you mentioned Roosevelt in his first term. Just want to hear about antitrust, because he's trying to get industry together. Okay. And then he just switches because he didn't read anything, and he said this. That didn't work. Let's try this. Right? Okay. But being Roosevelt, he did act. Okay? So when he acts, he puts in Thurman Arnold. I mean, all of a sudden, we get very tough enforcement with a president who probably didn't think about it too much after that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not an old thing. You know, you don't need in this case, an actor, not some intellectual believer in an antitrust America. Okay, fine. Today, politics changed. Okay, that's clear. I mean, I deny that. Okay, fine. That's historically that has happened in the past. Okay, despite we go on about bipartisan antitrust in the United States, it is largely bipartisan. It looks a lot. If economics is the only source of theory and models and law, and if economists are agreed, well, you don't need politics, right? This becomes, and people have said this, it's hilarious. People said writing 10 years ago, one person I love, right? Certainly right about this. This has all become technocratic now. I mean, economics is telling you what to do, and that's all right. Okay, that's from a pragmatic point of view, politics clearly important. Now more, okay, that has to do with the level of enforcement.
So really, well, this discussion, I mean, there are obviously other values that are either new, such as, I don't know, privacy rights, labor rights, we talk about sustainability rights now, or other concepts that may rest on more, let's say, modern economic concepts like network effects and so forth. So what's your view, if any, on these developments that we have seen some discussions in the US, but there's also a lot of, I would say, development in Europe mainly, and some other countries worldwide. I mean, do you have any view on those news, okay, the so-called new values?
Yeah, here's Barry Horse Monday morning on that. We've seen that politics are clearly important in terms of the strength of enforcement, certainly a federal enforcement. Reagan's another example. Okay. Yeah. So we have too many historical examples. And we're seeing it now, okay, of politics affecting the enforcement now. Yeah. But it's not simply enforcement, although when you think that reading again, force a lot of it's if you're going to not just making speeches about enforcement, but you want to stop something, you want to change something, then you either, okay, be really cynical, you either, and you can do this to some extent in mergers. Merger system, you just simply by policy announcements and enforcement announcements, you change behavior. You stop a merger simply because people, sort of the pre-notification system, people are just unwilling to go through, they're not willing to spend the money, engage the cost, time to finish the job. So you can actually you can change the business behavior without a court. Now, in monopolies, you can't do that. Monopolization, right? You've got to go to court. So that raises what you're raising. How do you persuade the court that the conduct is unlawful? Well, you've got your, again, economic theories, which are clearly relevant. No one's going to argue that an economic theory, well, it's hard to argue it's not relevant, right? But let's say you go in and you argue, and you can find legislative history to support this, some statement, right? Effect on employment or effect on political corruption or more vaguer to get at, undue influence. So what is undue influence? Right? Political influence. Right? Okay, that's your theory, right? Well, that's let's say a judge could react two ways. But it's the judge, and this is what we don't know. What are courts going to do? I'm a little more optimistic, right? Because courts adjust, right? So I'm not one way of saying all this is, trying to predict it, is the FTC, just they're going to lose all these cases because you've got these Chicago school conservative justices, judges, and they're not going to buy into any of these new theories, either the new economic theories, or they're not going to entertain a theory that's not an economic theory. It's got to be based on economic model. I'm not as certain about that. But if you're, but there is, I think they will distinguish between what they view rightly or wrongly as an economic-based theory or another theory, because they're going to say, what's your theory? Well, so what are the facts? Prediction is, I'm not completely pessimistic that today's judges, right? And there are a lot of them, hundreds of them, right? Okay, that they are necessarily, well, not necessarily, certainly not necessarily, but I don't know what the odds are, but I think the odds are better than 20-30%. I think it's higher than that, right? That they would be willing to entertain a broader economic or social argument. But it's going to be preferably, but this is a litigation. This is all about litigation, not theory, right? Because you're in litigation, the challenger, the FTC, should wrap that theory as much as they can, or the concern. Let's say you got a concern, right? Or a concern fact. You want to wrap it as much as you can in some economic theory. Economic theory, some person, some human being who is in the economics community, who has ideally a Nobel Prize in economics. Yeah. Okay. And then you move to another author who's didn't get a Nobel Prize in economics, is not a professor of economics, doesn't have a PhD in economics. I don't know what they've got. They got something else, right? Because they at this point won't have as much credibility. If I'm now the challenger, I can find case law, United States Supreme Court case law, that talks about your concerns, talks about political and social concerns of concentration. So I can write a brief citing that. I know the defendants are going to come in and cite it. They're going to cite, but not so much. They can also cite some Supreme Court decisions about consumer welfare. So I know, but I can go back in history and statements. If I'm one of the defendants, I probably had the better, because I can see, well, those statements are old and they don't reflect the law anymore, blah, blah, blah. But I'll stop here. But let's say you make a good argument with the FTC or challenger here that these, there's a whole set. Okay, here's what I would think about. If I were a lawyer, I'm not here on this, right? Trying to develop a case on that side, the plaintiff side, government side, I would try to show that the concerns. We're in a new economy. I'll call it a digital economy, right? It is raising new concerns that require us to go. They're not the same as these older concerns, either in 1890 or the early 1960s and the 50s. I'm not saying that, but they are new. They're different from what they were 10 or 15 years ago. They're sort of like some prior periods, and they're not strictly speaking price or output effects. It's the R effects of innovation, which is pretty vague, right? It's harder to get at prices, right? Effects on it. They are social, the dislocation, the privacy concerns, the political concerns, misinformation, blah, blah, blah. And I know there's a vast body of writing out there, so I'm sure you could put together a good brief basis, and you could get expert witnesses with all kinds of fancy models, and if you want algorithms, have models in them, about the harms coming from harms to privacy, political to civility, blah, 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 from certain business practices. All right, now. You did that, maybe you'd persuade a court that, but what you'd have, okay, and I'll stop here. I think you, to get you, what you should also do is address these political, the legal process advantages of a narrow antitrust law, more predictable rules, more transparent rules, no false positives, and so much by legal process. All those justifications for the narrowing, the retrenchment of U.S. antitrust law that courts are very concerned about. So you'd want to show, look, if you look to my political concern, I don't want to call it a political concern, I'll call it, assuming it's a political concern, it's not going to make the law more unpredictable if you use my political concern.
So we're definitely living very interesting times in that sense, because we might be witness to an era of changes again. Maybe we get at a certain point to the fifth period in your next book. But as we, and haven't read part of the book, I think that at least nowadays, and you talk about legal proceedings, due process, and that might be my last question today, because we have to finish. How things may have changed between the early days, colonial days, nowadays. We are currently witnessing these intense discussions on breaking up monopolies in the digital market or controlling inflation, for example, during COVID. For example, prices of gasoline in the US and other countries. In your book, you reflect an idea of institutions and rule of law versus a more, outrageous way of dealing with these issues back in the past. Do you think that that there's a different way of dealing with these issues nowadays, let's say more due process, legal process, that in the past was maybe, I don't know, I will rake your company or you have riots. Do you see any evolution there?
Oh, that's a really big question. I think we don't riot anymore. In the United States, we used to riot over what I'll call economic things, like the price of food went up. And you had riots in the 19th century, serious riots in the 19th century, okay? And some of the most interesting riots I found was during the American Revolution, where it got patriotic. So it wasn't just the prices went up. These evil monopolists who were raising prices were also hurting the war effort against the Brits. Because once you called a monopolist, what you were complaining directly about was they were raising prices. But by calling a monopolist, that evoked monopolist they were a recipient of government trading privileges, that kind of monopoly. And everybody hated that because that caused the blah, blah, blah. So the rioting then, there was no rioting about private firm monopolies. Why? Because the people who complained about private firm monopolies were very few, and they were competitors who tended not to go out in the streets, right, and riot, right? Okay, so that's one thing. But why? And today, when the price of gasoline went up, and during COVID, you had price gouging laws at the state level in the United States, okay? I don't know as we had rioting. I don't remember rioting in the States. But there was a lot of, it never got to that point. I mean, the state legislatures responded. This is totally contrary to the federal, contrary to the policies of federal antitrust laws and the whole media and all the economics community. We don't like price control. Nobody likes price controls, what have you. When you were getting price controls at the local level, that was during the American Revolution, George Washington wanted price controls. Okay, and then you see the same kind of debate. It ends up, if you want to look at classes of people, class defined by terms of how much money you had or assets you had and education, then you had people with more education and more assets on the one side who were always more moderate. I'll take this is a specific example of this, right, in the book, right? But let's just take one American during the American Revolution. So you'd have these riots in Massachusetts and Boston for the food and hoarding and what have you, for stalling. People, they're taking advantage of the embargo. You always had a tension between the sometimes you have merchants sort of helping out on the rioting, right? In fact, arguably, there were a lot of merchants involved in the Boston Tea Party. Boston Tea Party, they all dressed themselves up as Indians, right? Well, then you see there were debates or other merchants, the more sober-minded people, the lawyers, you know, whoa, you know, we don't, it's not a good idea. We don't want riots, right? Either because it's not a generally good thing, the riots, the people will get out of control. So there are examples in that period of a difference. You had moderates and the more radicals at that period. And the moderates, as you'd expect, I mean, common sense, right, tended to be, maybe they were both, on one hand, the radicals were not merchants. They were, some of them were merchants, and maybe majority, but a lot of them were not merchants. They were actually customers, right? The moderates tended to be more the merchants, the business, the lawyers, what have you, right? Today, to get to your, so that there was always a tension there between law and order, with some people saying, well, maybe it's a horrible thing, it's happening, but we have a court solution here. And I'll stop. It's interesting, in the forestall, they had always forestalling statutes. They were hardly ever enforced. Well, the evidence of enforcement's little. Now, how do you get the evidence? You didn't have good records of course cases. So it's easy, if you want to build a record against forestalling statutes, you should say, well, in Massachusetts, there was only one case in 48 years or something. Well, that's not, yeah, because we didn't keep records in the 18th century of forestalling cases the way we do today. So it's easy to fool around with how many cases there were. But there seems to be a lot of people say at the time, contemporaries, we need tougher enforcing. We don't need tougher forestalling laws. We need tougher enforcement because they never get enforced. And when they do get enforced, the challenger loses, the defendant wins, because the judges then either don't like the law, or the judges impose all kinds of these horrible legal requirements, due process requirements, and the plaintiff can't prove its case. And they're great statements like that. So you get, even then, you got this sort of legal break or constraint on popular enthusiasm to do stuff. Because you got in the courts, and then you got a court system. And it's okay. So you see that, the law and order, including court resolution on the one side and rioting and disorder on the other side. Now, why don't we do it today? We do it today in other areas. We don't in the United States. My guess is we don't have rioting anything the way we used to have in the 18th century. There's just a lot more violence, right? My feeling, right? That's a good question, Pablo. My guess would be, why don't we have more rioting, certainly racial rioting, rioting about civil rights. We don't, even Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street, it's a good question. I mean, why? Occupy Wall Street never got violent. Or if it did, it can, I don't remember it getting terribly violent, right? Okay. So, Steven Pinker wrote a book on the whole world globally. We're a lot less violent than we used to be. That he gets attacked by historians. Well, you're not a historian, you don't understand. I don't know, but it's you had what would then be called progressives. They called themselves progressives. Party, God, now I can't forget the name. It's terrible. Nothing. It was a political party in New York in the 1830s, and they were really against monopoly. And it went beyond government grants monopoly. It was vaguer, but they were against business, essentially, unless you're a really small shopkeeper, right? And they had riots in New York City. That's the 1830s, but yeah, then we had a civil war, which, you know, dwarfs rioting, right? I mean, a war, right? So I don't know the answer to that. That's a very interesting.
I think you answered my question. It was more a general question, and listening to your thoughts, everything obviously changes between countries and cultures and the evolution of these issues in each of the countries. You've mentioned price control. Price controls do still exist in many jurisdictions like Argentina. So we may have a completely different conversation if we were analyzing not monopoly in the US, but monopoly, for example, in Argentina or in some other Latin American countries or other countries from around the world. So. I think your book is absolutely interesting for all those who are interested in the costs of things and that I'm trying to understand why we are where we are now. So it's a great momentum also to read all these thoughts and reflections on your research, because that also leads us to better understand why we are where we are now again. So I will invite everybody to read the book. So once we read it, we might have another conversation, maybe in 3 years more again, and see if we are getting into this fifth era on your book, or we're still there in the fourth, in the current era that you mentioned in your book. Barry, any final thoughts or any comments before we finish?
No. Thank you. I think we're in the fifth era. The question of whether the judge is over in the fifth era, and they can kill it, right? But I think that we're in it. I don't think we'll go back to where we were.
Great.
But I don't know how far into it we're going to get. But it's all it's cycles. I'm in cycles, so we're just going through another cycle.
Yep. Anyway. Well, Barry.
Okay, look, thank you
very much once again. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Take care.